Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. And it's always a pleasure to welcome you back for our Wednesday Lunch and Learn. It's clear that the topic has generated a lot of excitement. But you should know we're here every Wednesday. And obviously Rabbi Flug is in a class of his own, but each week we have fantastic speakers. And I actually do want to draw your attention to next week's presentation, which is fantastic. It's a multimedia presentation on the archaeology of Yerushalayim. And actually next year, God willing, we're going to be bringing the speaker in for an 8-part series. But next week's going to be a little bit of a teaser. So please tell your friends, it's really a fantastic opportunity. And secondly, as always, we are happy to provide lunch for those who are coming. And if you're interested in sponsoring a week, please speak to me or Matthew or Simone in the office. This week's Lunch and Learn is actually not yet sponsored. So if you are able, if you have anything, as always, we leave our box out there. These programs do cost the show money, so we ask for a suggested donation of $5 when the Lunch and Learn is not sponsored. Please consider leaving $5 on your way out. Okay, this afternoon we have the privilege of hearing from Rabbi Josh Flug, who is no stranger to our community. Rabbi Flug is... What's your official title? Director of Torah Research at Yeshiva University, where he is a beloved member of the staff of the Center for the Jewish Future. And again, I could speak personally, and I know I speak on behalf of Rabbi Goldberg as well. He is an incredible resource to have locally. He is a gift to any rabbi, right? He's any rabbi's dream to have in their community. So I want to thank Rabbi Flug for agreeing to give the class today and for being such a resource to our community and to being a resource to the Yeshiva University community as well. The topic today, of course, is the Jewish perspectives on the gun control debate. Obviously a highly contested, very emotional topic in light of what happened a few weeks ago in Newtown, Connecticut. So I will ask the following. Rabbi Flug has agreed to take questions during his presentation, but I sincerely ask that the questions are on topic and relevant to what he is talking about. As he said, questions of clarification, not questions of the editorial nature. And Rabbi Flug has been instructed to, and I'll be in here as well, that if the questions are of editorial nature, that I'm going to ask the questioner to hold it until the end, after the class. Again, everyone has very strong feelings on the topic, and perhaps there are valid opinions on both sides. We're not here to hear your opinions, we're here to hear the Jewish perspective on it. So again, if something that Rabbi Flug is talking about, as he's talking about the Gemara and Avodah Zarah, and you have a question about the Gemara, feel free to ask your question. If you want to share your own personal thoughts on the gun control debate, so you will be asked to withhold your question until later on. And again, it's just a sensitivity thing to everyone else in the room. So again, without further ado, I give you Rabbi Flug, and I thank him again very much for coming and agreeing to give his class.
Thank you, Rabbi Moskowitz, for the kind introduction. If you were following the schedule from the beginning, or I assume it's listed this way in the catalog, this wasn't the topic that I was listed for. I asked Rabbi Moskowitz if he would mind if I switched it, and needless to say, he did not mind. We know why we're discussing this today, and Rabbi Moskowitz already introduced the topic. But this is a topic that comes up over and over. It's a topic that comes up over and over again. Unfortunately, this is not the only shooting that we've had in the past year. Perhaps for a variety of issues, it didn't come to the forefront as much in the shooting in Colorado, maybe because it was before an election or because there weren't kids involved. We could discuss, you know, from today to tomorrow why it didn't come up, but now it's really becoming an issue at the front of all news media. And you have different perspectives on it. You have people who are saying that if we would have had stricter gun control laws, this wouldn't have happened. And then you have people saying, well, if the teachers would have been armed, this wouldn't have happened. So you have people on both ends of the spectrum saying, yeah, we need to change something. The question is, what do we need to change? The debate about gun control has been going on for years, and there are conflicting studies on this. You have studies that say that tighter gun control laws prevent crime, and you have studies on the other side that say that tighter gun control laws actually increase crime because people don't have guns to protect themselves. I am not going to stick my nose into figuring out which study is correct. There's probably an element of truth to both sides. I don't know to what extent. We generally have a rule. You know, when we learn the Talmud, we generally assume that there can't be a dispute about facts. So you have a dispute in the Talmud, and one side says this, and one side says this, and it seems to look like a dispute about a specific fact. So we try to figure out a way that it's more of a dispute about opinion as opposed to fact, because we assume that through experimentation you can find out any fact that you want. But that's not always the case. You can have, especially when you deal with the psychology of human beings. You know, here we're not studying whether this is made out of X or out of Y. We're studying what people do in certain situations, and people behave differently in different situations. So you're naturally going to have studies that have different results. So I'm not going to get into that. But just be aware that when we try to figure out how to apply it, so you're going to have different people applying it different ways because people believe different things about what the facts are. Another piece I'm not going to discuss is U.S. law on the Second Amendment, meaning the Talmud doesn't deal with that aspect of it. You know, if you are of the opinion that the Constitution that the Second Amendment means that everybody is allowed to own whatever gun they want, and so the only way to deal with that is to make a constitutional amendment. So, okay, that's something which needs to be discussed, but not in this shiur. Similarly, if you hold the opposite, that the Second Amendment doesn't afford such options, then it obviously doesn't become as much of an issue, and legislation is potentially an option. Okay, so I'm going to start with the following. Well, keep in mind also that obviously times are different now than they were in the times of the Talmud. So yes, we do hear the fact that we know that giving a gun to somebody can either result in them being able to defend themselves or them being able to kill somebody else. But the ramifications of that in Talmudic times was a little bit different, because you sort of knew, or there was sort of an assumption of who the good guys were and who the bad guys were. So they lived in, especially during the time of the Roman persecution, you give a weapon to a Roman, he's probably going to use it to kill another Jew. You give a weapon to a Jew, he's going to use it to defend himself from the Romans who are trying to kill the Jews. And unfortunately, Jewish history has a lot of stories. You can substitute Romans with Persians, with a lot of different groups of people. So just keep that in mind as we go through this, that's part of it. We're going to start with something which may or may not be intuitive, and that's the prohibition of lifnei iver lo sitein michshol. Do not place a stumbling block before a blind person. We have a prohibition in the Torah not to place a stumbling block before a blind person, and the Talmud gives a level of interpretation beyond the literal level of interpretation. That's source one. Okay, how do we know that a person should not hand a cup of wine to a nazir? That's somebody who took an oath not to drink wine, or a piece of Aver Menachai to a Ben Noach. Here, all it's highlighting is the fact that a non-Jew also is prohibited from eating Aver Menachai, flesh from a live animal. It's not singling out non-Jews here. It's just saying you can't give it to a Jew or a non-Jew. So how do we know this? You shall not place a stumbling block before a blind person. Okay, so the additional level of interpretation is you can't, I'm using these terms here. I'll throw out a bunch of terms, and we'll see which one the Gemara means. Assist, enable, abet somebody in violating a prohibition. So you have this nazir. He wants to drink a cup of wine. He's not allowed to drink the cup of wine. You cannot give it to him. Okay. So then the Gemara asks, but can't they just get it themselves? Meaning the Nazir wants to drink a cup of wine. So let him, if you're not going to give it to him, he's going to do it anyway. He's going to go to the store and he's going to buy a cup of wine. So what's the problem? So the Gemara says we're dealing with a situation where the only wine or mita is on the other side of the river. Meaning he's standing there, the bridge is closed, he wants the cup of wine right now, and the only way he's going to get it is if you give it to him. So that's the prohibition. Lifnei iver l'sitei michshol, do not place a stumbling block before a blind person. Meaning that what if he has other options? He has another way of getting the wine, he has another way of getting the meat. So that's fine. It's not lifnei iver, and so now we can come to a more precise term that lifnei iver is enabling as opposed to assisting. Assisting seems to not be a violation of lifnei iver, whereas enabling somebody is a violation of lifnei iver. So, if we were to talk about providing weapons to somebody, we could potentially say that providing weapons to somebody would not be a violation of lifnei iver, even if the person is going to use them for something. Let's say for a crime. It doesn't even have to be murder. He's going to use it to rob a store. Okay, so the guy walks into your store, says, "I would like to buy a gun." Yeah, what do you need a gun for? "I just want to rob that bank across the street." Well, sure, here's the gun, because it's not a problem, because if you don't go to my store, you can go to another store, not say anything, and you'll get it anyway. So if we followed the strict... I'm trying to create some tension here. If we followed the strict rules of lifnei iver, right, if we said the rule is the only problem in enabling somebody is if he has no other way of getting it, so then it might not be a problem. Now, I'm aware, Tosos points this out, and I don't have it on the source sheet, but there are a number of sources that say that yes, lifnei iver doesn't apply, but you can never assist somebody. That's a rabbinic law. You're not allowed to assist somebody in violating a prohibition. Depending on what the situation is, it could be if it's only if he states explicitly. If he walks into the store and says, "I'm going to rob the bank," you can't give him the gun. If he walks into your store and he says, "Give me, I want to buy some cheese because I want to make a cheeseburger," you cannot sell him the cheese. If he brings the cheese to the counter, you don't have to ask him, "What are you going to do with that cheese? Are you going to use it to eat it by itself or with something else?" But if you know for sure, that's the Ritva says this, that if you know for sure that he's going to use it for a prohibition, so there's a rabbinic prohibition in assisting somebody. But generally, if you don't know anything, you don't have to assume that he's going to use it for something evil. He could use it for something neutral or something good. That's the general rule of lifnei iver. Then we come to the source number two, which is the specific topic about providing weapons to people, and we seem to have a whole different perspective. Or the rules of lifnei iver, the regular rules, don't seem to be followed here. Okay. So here we're talking about one should not sell weapons to them, and it's talking about, it's a longer discussion about dealing with Ovdei Avodah Zarah. This is part of a broader question. Do we mean, whenever it says Akum, does it mean all non-Jews or does it mean idolaters? In this case, it means people, and this is discussed in later sources, the Chavos Yar, the Chachmas Sadim say this, it talks about people, and then it's clear from the discussion in the Talmud, anyone who's suspicious of murdering you. So when we talk about idolaters, it means somebody who we don't trust, and we're worried that they're going to kill you if they had the opportunity. We have discussions in the Talmud, in Avodah Zarah, about seclusion with such a person. You can't go into a room alone because, you know, you may not come out. There's a discussion about getting a haircut from someone if there's no mirror there, because again, The guy is holding a sharp scissor. And unfortunately, this was the way it was back in Talmudic times. These laws, the Chavos Yar, the Chachma Sadam say, do not apply nowadays. But you have to read the Talmud, nevertheless, in that context, that there were people, you know, that murder was people were murdering Jews indiscriminately. So you can't sell to them weapons or accessories of weapons. So you can't, even if they have a knife holder or a sword holder, you can't sell them the sword holder. You can't sharpen their weapons. You can't sell them chains to arrest people. And you can't even sell them to the kusim. The kusim, they were fine. They were kind of like, you know, they do their own thing. So they weren't going to kill any Jews, but they would have no problem selling the weapons to the non-Jews. So we don't want the weapons getting in the hands of people who are going to use it for murder. So not only don't we sell to the people who are actually suspicious, we don't sell to people who are going to distribute them to people who are suspicious or who have no qualms about distributing them who are suspicious. Then Rav Dimi Bar Abba comes along and says, just as it's forbidden to sell to an idolater, it's forbidden to sell to a robber who is an Israelite. You can't sell it to a Jewish ganav, right? You have a Jewish gazlan ganav. You can't sell him the weapon either. Okay, so what's the problem with that? Meaning, what's the problem? Of course, you would say, of course, the problem. He's going to use it to. So the Gemara says, well, what are the circumstances? If he's suspected of murder, then we know. Meaning, you can't sell it to a Jewish murderer. That doesn't need to be stated. But what about a Jewish robber? So the Gemara says, well, what's the problem with that? If he's going to use it for murder, it's one thing. But what if he just wants to use it to rob a bank? Now, why am I asking this here? I mean, why is the Gemara asking this here? I think it's because if you look back at the rules of Lifnei Iver, so what's the difference between selling the weapon to the bank robber and, or at least you can at least read it like this for now. What's the difference between selling the weapon to the bank robber and selling the wine, the cup of wine to the Nazir if he can go next door and get the wine? Either way, he's going to do what he wants to do. So it's not Lifnei Iver. So the Gemara qualifies it. So we're dealing here with a cowardly thief who is apt at times to try to save himself. And we'll see there are two interpretations of what that means. The Gemara calls him Mashmuta. He's going to use this, let's just put it vaguely for now. He's going to use the weapon as part of his escape plan. Okay, so he's going to rob the bank, and he's not going to use it necessarily to threaten people's lives. If he's going to threaten people's lives, then that comes into perhaps the suspicion of murder. And he's going to walk into the bank. He's not going to say, I have a gun. He's just going to have the gun there for his own protection. If he needs to get out somehow and they stop him on the way out, he'll point the gun, they'll move out of his way, and he'll move on. Okay, so that's piece one of this discussion in the Talmud. Then there's two more pieces here. One more piece. The Talmud says you can't sell guns to or weapons. You can't sell shields. It's machlokas. Some say you sell them shields. However, some say that you cannot sell them shields, and there are some that say that you can sell them shields. Why would we prohibit shields? Because the shield is going to be used to protect them. Meaning, if they're going to battle, they're going to use the shield. Maybe they're not going to kill anybody with the shield, but it'll help them last longer in the battle. And or to put it the equivalent now, can you sell a bulletproof vest to somebody? So if the person is a known, if he's suspicious, then that's what the dispute is about. And then the Gemara says, well, wait a second, if you can't sell something that's used for protection purposes, then you shouldn't sell them food either. Meaning, if the person is a suspected murderer, if you sell him food, he's going to live another day, and he's going to potentially murder more people. So The Gemara comments, well, maybe you shouldn't sell food, but we have no way of getting around that. Meaning, like, if you stop selling food to the Romans, they're going to come in and start killing you, so we have no choice with that. But the shields, you could say, like, I'm not in this business, or whatever. There's apparently is a way out of that. But the Gemara also qualifies it and says maybe the shields is more problematic because it's not like a bulletproof vest. A shield, if your sword gets knocked out of your hand, what do? You take the shield and you start using it actively. So maybe a shield is a kind of weapon. Maybe that's why there's a prohibition against shields. Okay, we're not going to discuss so much about the shield, so don't worry if you didn't follow that. And then here's a really important line. The Gemara then talks about selling materials that can be molded into weapons. So can you sell them bars of iron? So the Gemara initially says, no, you can't sell iron to them because they may make weapons out of them. So the Gemara says, if you can't sell them iron, then you shouldn't be able to sell them like anything, like any metal tool. They could just melt it down, meaning you have to melt the iron anyway. So if you sell them a pickaxe or a farming tool, then they could just as easily melt that down and turn it into a sword. So the Gemara says, no, that's not a problem. What we mean is you can't sell them bars of Parzla Hindoa, Indian iron. Meaning it was a specific type of metal that was only used for weapons. So if you know that they're trying to purchase this type of metal, you know what they're going to do with it. If they want to take an axe or a hoe and turn it into a sword, so, what are we going to do? Like, it's not our problem. And then, the important part is the comment on this. Why then do we sell it now? Meaning, why do we sell what? Why do we sell them iron bars, or why do we sell them weapons? That's a question. But the assumption seems to be, why do we sell them weapons now? Meaning, after this whole discussion that you're not allowed to sell weapons to non-Jews, or to people who are suspicious, at least, of murder, why is it that common practice in Babylonia, in the time of Ravashi, was that people did sell them weapons? Because we sell it to the Persians who protect us. Because they're protecting us. So what does that mean now? That we're selling them, you could sell them weapons, and again, we're dealing with people, are we talking about people who are suspicious? So they're suspicious, but they protect us, so that's fine. Or is it people who are not suspicious, and because they're not suspicious and they protect us, it's fine. But if they, let's say, these aren't like the highest paid security guards, so we need to provide them with weapons, but if you get them a little angry, they're going to turn against you. So what's the situation here? But the bottom line is that we have this idea that you have to factor that in as well. That if we are, that if they're protecting us, then there's a leniency to sell them the weapons. So we'll get into that more a little at the end. Okay. Well, what I want to focus on for the next few minutes is the question, and we'll do it through the eyes of this particular passage in the Talmud. What happened to Lifnei Iver? Are the rules of Lifnei Iver suspended when we're dealing with weapons? And if they are, why? Right, what is it that makes this the exception to the rule? Normally, you don't have to worry about providing something that can be used for a prohibition. That's normally not a concern. When it comes to weapons, there's a specific concern. What's the obvious answer? Yeah? Well, meaning, why should a weapon... What's the difference between selling a guy a weapon and selling somebody a cheeseburger?
Because the weapon can be used against
you. Right, the weapon can be used to kill somebody. Right, that's the obvious answer. But in order to sort of refine exactly what the parameters of this are, let's figure out what we're dealing with when we talk about the thief. Okay, because the thief, are we talking about murder, or are we expanding it beyond murder to even other things? So Rashi says, the Talmud here refers to a thief who takes money from a property owner and runs away. When they chase after him, he fights back and saves himself and causes the property owner a loss of money. Right? The Rashi is clearly not just worried about... Well, Rashi doesn't say anything about murder. Let's assume that for Rashi, this fellow whatever, he's not the violent type. He's not going to... We know him well. You know, he would never hurt a fly. But, so we're pretty sure he's not going to use that weapon to kill anybody, but the bank doesn't know that. And so when he waves his gun, they'll move out of the way, and he'll be able to rob the bank more easily because he gets the weapon. So we're not dealing with murder, even if it's not murder, even if it's beyond murder, even if it's for a crime of stealing money. So we don't want to allow this person to get away with it. Rabbeinu Nisim says the following: it's prohibited to sell to a Jewish thief, even though he's not known murderer. Since he is a thief, he is likely to commit murder to prevent them from catching him and sentencing him. So Rabbeinu Nisim is focused specifically on the murder itself as opposed to the robbery. If we knew for sure, again, he says you can never know for sure, but if we knew for sure that he wasn't going to be violent, or let's say like this, what would be a practical difference? Let's say this fellow wanted to buy a BB gun that looks just like a real gun. So Rashi will say, well, he's going to use that for a bank robbery, so we cannot allow him to rob a bank with a BB gun. Rabbeinu Nisim says, well, he can't really kill anybody with it. Or let's say it's a water gun that just looks like a gun. So there's no way he's going to kill anybody with that. He's just going to use it as part of his escape plan. And since we're not dealing with actual murder, so the regular rules of Lifnei Iver would apply here. Again, for, like I mentioned earlier, the Ritva says if you state explicitly what your intention is when you purchase the thing and it's for a prohibited activity, then we can't allow it on a rabbinic level. But most people, when they purchase weapons, they don't say, hey, you know, I want to buy this thing because I want to go rob a bank. They're just going and buying it. So according to Rashi, if the person, let's say, if it's a water gun that's designed, that's why they don't design water guns like that. If the water gun is designed, if it's a replica gun that looks very real, or if it's a broken gun that nobody will ever know that it doesn't work, so Rashi will say you cannot sell it to him because he's going to use it to, meaning you can't sell it to him if he's suspicious, if he's you know, if he's an upstanding citizen and he wants to use it to protect himself. I'm talking about the broken gun, so Rashi will say fine, but if he's suspicious, meaning he's a known bank robber, he's never committed any murder, he just wants to buy this thing to get out of the bank next time, so Rashi says absolutely not. Rabbeinu Nisim will say, well, what could we do? We have the regular rules of Lifnei Iver to stop us from, meaning if he can get it somewhere else, so fine. And therefore, Lifnei Iver does not apply, and it would be permissible as long as it's not going to be used for a murder. Now, it does get a little more complicated, because when you take out a gun, even if people think it's fake, so there could be violence that ensues after, and he could get killed. So,
how far do you carry it?
What?
How far do you carry it? If someone is known to have a very hot temper, you say you can't sell it to him either?
Right, so right now we're talking just, Rashi and Rabbeinu Nisim are talking just about crime. Rashi's talking about robbery. Rabbeinu Nisim's talking about actual murder. But otherwise, the regular rules, meaning if somebody goes to buy a baseball bat in Sports Authority, he can use it for a crime. I mean, you can use anything. Right. So we don't ask questions, and the person will do whatever he does with it. But when you're dealing with something which is a weapon, so then there's sort of like a...
You have someone who has a very hot temper and you don't know. And he's coming to buy a weapon.
Right, so we don't... So Rashi nor Rabbeinu Nisim address that, and let's assume that it's not part of that prohibition. Right? Rashi's only taking it the way... If you don't want to be expansive, Rashi's only limiting it to using it for somebody who's a known... He's a known robber. Mm-hmm. Right? Rabbeinu Nisim might say... Wait, this guy has a hot temper, and if he has a violent history, meaning let's say he didn't murder people, but he's been known to lose it every once in a while, so he might say, the same way that we're worried about the bank robber using the gun, so yeah, maybe that would be, yeah.
Does the stumbling block apply to both murder and theft?
It applies, meaning the stumbling block applies all over. Right, there's a limitation in the stumbling block prohibition in that if the person can get the item somewhere else, So there's no biblical prohibition of placing a stumbling block. And what I'm suggesting here is that the Talmud is expanding it in the case of weapons specifically to say, well, the regular rules don't apply. For Rashi, it means the regular rules don't apply and you have to worry about crime or loss of life or loss of property. And for Rabbeinu Nissim, you have to worry about this situation. You have to assess the situation and figure out whether there's a chance that it can get violent and turn into something worse. Yeah.
But in most cases, a person who commits an act of violence or crime or weapon did not buy it through a legal channel. And also, as happened in Connecticut, it wasn't the person who bought it that did the act, it was the son who stole the weapon.
Right.
So now you have
okay, so that might be similar to what it says about the Kusim. That the Kusim, they weren't going to kill anybody, but they didn't really have any qualms about selling the weapon to somebody else. So the question is, how do you know this? There's no way to know this in advance. I mean, you can't. If you know that this person has had, you know, has made bad decisions in the past, and you know, every time you sell him a gun, it ends up in a crime. So yes, that would be like the Kusim. If the person has no history of this, so we can't just like say, okay, you know, I don't like the fact that you chose the worst food at that restaurant, so you make very bad decisions. I'm not going to trust you for this either. You know, there has to be something to go on, that the person has a, you know, some sort of, there has to be some legitimate suspicion that the person's going to do something wrong with the weapon. But yeah, it doesn't necessarily have to be that the person is a bad person. The Kusim were not murderers, but they just didn't use proper judgment in the selling of the weapons. Yeah. Yeah. Meaning, why isn't he worried about the bank robbery? That's a good question. I think the point is that, you know, this was, you know, if somebody's in the business of selling weapons all day, you know, to ask them to vet each person, and here we're talking about, you know, he's already not selling. His store is closed to anyone except the Jews because he doesn't trust anybody else. So now, if a guy walks in, you know, and he's a bank robber, maybe he's just buying the weapon because, you know, he has a lot of cash in the house and he's worried that they're going to come after him, you know?
Well, how would he know that he's a bank robber?
What?
How would he know that he's a bank robber?
I don't know. They, right, I don't know. However they knew. I don't know exactly what was going on. They knew that this guy was a known, he was a known robber. Yeah. Say that again? If
all the distributors, all the manufacturers are Jewish. So there are other vendors who get the stick, but they didn't check the
stick. Okay, yeah, so that's a good point. The Mishnah LeMelech addresses that in general in Lifnei Iver. So let's say you have this, the Nazir case, right? So the guy is looking for a cup of wine. But all the people who sell wine, they all know that this fellow is a Nazir and they all abide by the same standards. So do you say there that that's not called Trey of Redenari? It's like this guy is on the other side of the river, meaning you're on the same side of the river with him, with five other people, but you're all in the same boat together. So yes, that's an important point. The Mishnah Melech says that if everyone had to abide by the same standards, and everybody did abide by the same standards, then we don't call that able to get it somewhere else, right? Because he can't really get it somewhere else if everybody follows the rules. So. Right, so then the question is, how do you apply that, let's say, like, where you can get it illegally, or you can get it at a place where people don't know who you are? Right. There's a federal background check system, but then let's say, in our case, let's say the thief, right? So the thief may not be able to get it locally, and maybe that's already, you know, like the other side of the river, or maybe the thief is not well known. You happen to know he's a thief, and you're a weapons dealer or a weapons store owner, but the guy next door doesn't know. If he walked in there, he would be able to get it. So there's no real meaning, there's no prohibition for him to sell it because he doesn't know. So it is interesting, you know, there is that comment of the Mishnah Melech. The question is, how would you apply it? And again, we're dealing with this on two levels. We're dealing with this from a morality standpoint, meaning like, if I as a voter or I as a citizen, we want to express our opinion, and hopefully our politicians will sort of make their decisions based on the will of the people. But then there's the legislative aspect of it, which we'll get to in a few moments. You know, if there is legislation that says you're not allowed to sell weapons under certain circumstances, so that is kind of like what we're dealing with here, that these are the rules and everybody has to follow them, and therefore if you violate the law and provide weapons to somebody under those circumstances, then it is potentially lifnei iver. Okay, I want to highlight just the Rambam actually mentions this whole Talmudic discussion. The Rambam codifies it in two places. I don't have it in the source sheet because he seemingly follows Rashi, that we're more concerned about the crime. It's about any type of crime, not just murder. That seems to be the consensus of many of the Rishonim. I just the Ran is kind of like the Rabbeinu Nissim is kind of on the other side in terms of that. But the Rambam sort of brings out what Rashi is saying in another comment, where we have an obligation to, there's a Torah obligation, Lo Sama Adam Re'acha, do not stand idly by your brother's blood. So we have an obligation to protect others. And the Rambam not only extends it he not only applies it to somebody who's drowning in the river, which is the case that he discusses, but also to save somebody's property as well. So maybe to sort of put this in a bigger picture, yeah, lifnei iver is an important value, and it has its limitations. So it's not lifnei iver if you provide something to somebody that can be used for good or for bad, and he decides to use it for bad, or if he can get it from somewhere else. But when we have a conflicting value of Lo Sama Al Dam Re'echa, about standing idly by your brother's blood, so then we have to push back at lifnei iver and say we have a competing value here. So we have to worry about the protection of others, and so the whole Talmudic discussion should be read with sort of that as the tension. That's the point of tension here. On the one hand, it's not technically a violation of lifnei iver because they have options to get it elsewhere. On the other hand, we have an obligation to protect people, and therefore we don't want people to commit murder. We don't want people to commit robbery either. Now, like I mentioned earlier, the Talmud says that nowadays, meaning in Talmudic times, we sell weapons to the idolaters, meaning to the Persians. Why? Because they protect us. Okay, and the Mugiyos, it points out, it's not just because you could have read the Gemara that when it says nowadays, why do we sell them? It was only talking about the iron bars. But the Mukhe Yosef of Yosef ibn Khabib says that we sell weapons that are fully assembled because they protect us. They fight on our behalf to protect the city and its inhabitants, and there is definite protection from danger, whereas there's only a small possibility that it may use it to harm a member of the Jewish community, and that is what we rely on. Meaning, when you give the weapons to the security guards, so we know what they're supposed to be used for. They're supposed to be used to protect us. It's possible that one of them will turn around and use it against us, but for the most part, we have what he says is a vadai versus a suffix. We have a definite protection, or close to definite protection. We, you know, for the most part, even if there's one bad apple, the rest of them are going to protect us. And when you weigh that against the potential of what can go wrong, so you have to weigh the benefits and the costs, which I think is really important here in general in discussing the whole gun control issue. You have to weigh the benefits against the costs. Now, we can debate from today till tomorrow what are the benefits and what are the costs, and people will have different opinions about that, but it is kind of central to understanding the whole thing here. Yeah?
We understand. We told them how to fight, and then they turned the weapons on us.
Yeah. Okay, I mean, yes, we know the potential danger in arming people, and we know the potential benefits that there are in arming people. Oh, I can't say we know. We don't know. Or we have a certain sense of what we think we know, what the potential benefits are and what the potential dangers are. And again, people, even in this room, are going to have different opinions in terms of what those are. You know, I don't think anyone would dispute the value of having an armed security guard who's trained and is vetted and everything else. But yes, there, with the recognition that you know, A, you get what you pay for. So if you hire low wage security guards, you're not necessarily gonna get the best vetting possible. You know, if the stepping stone to being a security guard was that first you had to be a trusted member of a multi-million dollar bank, you had to be the CEO of a multi-million dollar bank, so we know at that point that you're not going to use it for violence, so great, but then you'd have to pay through the nose to get such a high caliber person. So we know that there are potential benefits, we know that there are potential costs, and we have to just figure out what those are, if it's, and at least for the Nemuke Yosef, if it's a vadai versus a suffix, meaning you're certainly going to get protection versus the potential of doing harm, so then you would go with that. And what I mean by certain protection, meaning if they didn't have these security guards, they were in big trouble. It wasn't like, you know, this is just an added measure. This was, they were living in violent times. They needed some sort of protection. So what are you going to do? Now, they could have hired their own people who they trusted. I guess that wasn't an option, or maybe they weren't as qualified. So you go ahead with what seems reasonable in that situation. Now, again, like I say, you could spin this both ways on each side of the debate. That yes, you know, the NRA is saying, well, if you arm the teachers, we could trust the teachers, obviously, with our kids. So if you arm the teachers, so then we're not worried that they're going to turn the guns on anybody else. Or you could say the opposite, that we shouldn't arm anybody because we don't know who we could trust. So that's that's kind of like the debate from the eyes of the Nemuke Yosef. There's one last point. I mean, just till now, we were focused on providing weapons, and from a moral standpoint, in terms of what we should sort of see as what's supposed to be. You know, the Talmud never really discusses any prohibition about possessing weapons because, you know, why would there? There was no enforcement in those times, meaning like once you get it in their hands, that's it. So it's either giving it, you either give it to them, or you try to curb how much, you know, how much they get, and anything beyond that is kind of a moot point. So the discussion in the Talmud in terms of regulating weapons is providing them. If people who follow the halacha do not provide weapons to them, And this is talking to Jewish society as a whole. So, you know, in the bigger picture, they'll have less weapons. Will they get weapons elsewhere? Sure. You know, if I assume that the Jews were not the only people who made weapons. These were kind of like, sounds like you can just make these things at home anyway. So you had a piece of metal and you can melt it down. You could turn it into a sword if you knew, if you have a good blacksmith, which every local town had a good blacksmith. So it wasn't going to eliminate the problem totally, but at least there was a concern about the Jewish community doing its part to protect itself. At the same time, you know, there was a... we don't see any encouragement to this, but that the Jews themselves were allowed to sell weapons to fellow Jews, and the obvious reason for that was for their own protection. Now, I want to just discuss for a minute the legislative aspect of it. So there's a comment. The Rambam says this very briefly. I was debating whether to put the Rambam in or the Ran. It happens to be the same Rabbeinu Nissim in source 4. So if you have objections to him from that angle, you like what he has to say here. The Rambam says this, but you know, in terms of using it for a quotation, it's not as clear. So the Ran discusses the following. What's the role? And we have this in Tanakh already. What's the role of the king? So the Torah in Parsha Shoftim discusses it, and then it came up again when the Jews wanted a king. So they went to Shmuel, and he said, no, you don't really want a king. I'll tell you why, because he's going to do X, Y, and Z. And that's what's called the Parshas HaMelech, the Mishpat HaMelech, the law of the king. So Rabbeinu Nissim develops this idea, and he says, well, what's the purpose of the Mishpat HaMelech? Why do we have such a thing? Why do we need a king at all? Isn't it enough what it says in the Torah? We have a whole library of books, and including laws of monetary laws, and we have a mitzvah to appoint judges. So shouldn't that be enough? We have all the legislation. We have everything. What do we need a king for? So the Ran says... That Rabbeinu Nissim says there's another area that we need to deal with that's not dealt with directly in the Torah, and that's what he calls Yishuv Medini, or the political organization or the development of civilization. That, yes, there are laws, and if somebody murders, the Torah says exactly what to do with the person, that a murderer is put to death. But what happens if the murderer finds a loophole in the law? So we can't punish him in that situation. Why? Because we don't have proper witnesses. And then again, witnesses here means witnesses and warning. So, as you know, you read the news, most cases of murder don't have witnesses and warnings beforehand. Otherwise, the witnesses, you know, might have been able to stop the murder from taking place. So, the Talmud in Mako says that it was very rare that they ever put somebody to death. It could be that it was also rare that you had so many murders, but it's very rare that you're able to follow the whole protocol that it says in the Torah and actually punish people properly and maintain absolute order. So the Ran suggests that that's why we have the Mishpat HaMelech, the king. Why? Because the king doesn't have to follow the exact rules of what it says in the Torah. He can create his own laws, and anyone who doesn't follow the rule of the king... The Rambam says, "Kol amorei b'malchus," and we find throughout Tanakh, if you rebel against the king, and that means not listening to the king's decree, so the king has the reshus, he has the option to punish that person, however he wants, including capital punishment. So we're not talking so much, we're not going to focus so much on the capital punishment, but the point is that the king has the discretion to enact laws, and laws that are necessary because the Torah itself doesn't address them specifically. So yes, the Torah doesn't address, from Lifnei Iver, L'Sitein Michshol perspective, we don't necessarily have a law on the books that we could say, you know, this is how we should deal with gun control in our times. Right? We can quote sources, and we could spin our perspectives based on the facts. But in the end of the day, it's the king, or or what many assume that the king nowadays is the government, that the government has the discretion to figure out what's right for each society and for each time and place. Yeah?
Does the king have extrajudicial abilities? Meaning, can the king make a law that if you do X, then there's a death penalty where the Torah does not...
Yes, but there are limitations. A, he can't, and then this gets to freedom of religion. The Rambam says explicitly, if the king makes a law that that would violate a mitzvah, so then it's not binding, and the person, let's say if the king, I always point this out as an interesting thing, let's say the government, you know, like, Meheri Yibana HaMikdash, the base of HaMikdash is built, you can't have everybody drive up to Yerushalayim for Pesach and expect, like, there are people who are planning this, like parking lots and all this stuff, but at the end of the day, so let's say the choice is to park illegally or to bring your carbon Pesach. So the Rambam says you can't, the king can't do it. The king can't stop you from doing a mitzvah. The government enacted no parking in this spot. Well, you know, the Bezdin can. The Bezdin can say, that, let's say, you don't blow shofar on Shabbos because we're concerned about X, Y, and Z. So things like that, where it involves violation of a mitzvah, would actually have to be in the hands of the Bezdin and not the king. What the Ran is saying is that the king has these extrajudicial powers, and kol amor b'malchus nana shalav, if you rebel against the king, you're put to death, or you could be put to death, and the king has the right to enact these kinds of laws that will help... sort of organize society. Yeah?
I'm just going to sketch this. I don't express this well, but the principle of diminishment, as opposed to isn't discussed by the Chachamim. It has great implications for the duration of mankind's culture.
What do you mean by that?
Principle of diminishment, be it thievery, be it murder, why isn't that principle clarified?
Meaning, why doesn't the Talmud speak? The Talmud never spells out why. The Talmud just says you can't do X, Y, and Z. You can't sell the weapons to a thief, and you can't sell it to... So the Talmud never tells us why. I mean, not never. Here it doesn't. What?
It's absolutely diminishment.
Right. Right. But the point is that, for the most part, most of the Rishonim do see that as the problem here, that's why you can't sell the weapon to the thief.
And did they juxtapose this with
Tfilah?
Would be the next.
What do you mean? No, meaning. The discussion about the thief, it's almost tangential anyway, because the discussion is really about providing weapons to the enemy, right? So it doesn't really matter, and the answer is no. And then the Gemara discusses, well, what about to somebody who's not going to use it for murder, what about just for thievery? And the Gemara says no also. Right. Well, right. Rashi says because of diminishment, Rabbeinu Nissim does not go that far, or he takes a different approach, but yeah, and it could be. I mean, I don't want to take this too far, but maybe the two, source 4 and source 7, are right together, because Rabbeinu Nissim sees the goal of the king or the government as really dealing with those kinds of situations. So you don't have, the legal system was never expected to cover every situation. It was meant to cover what it says in the Torah and to apply it. And then you have this legal system of government, which is really to fill in the gaps and figure out how to deal with situations such as diminishment. I don't necessarily want to read the two Rabbeinu Nissims together, but it is the same person. And if he was here, he would say, well, yeah, great. I didn't address it from the legal perspective. I addressed it from the judicial perspective, I address it from the legislative perspective. Right. 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 So that's. It's addressed. That much is addressed. Whether it's legal or extra legal, that's the question here. So just to summarize, in the 2 minutes that we have, we presented this prohibition of lifnei iver. You can't place a stumbling block in front of a blind person. You can't enable somebody to violate a prohibition. You can't assist either. That's rabbinic in nature, and the parameters of that are more light. And if the person has other options, so the biblical prohibition of lifnei iver does not apply, yet it does apply to providing weapons. The question is why. So Rashi says, because you can't, when we're dealing with any type of crime, whether it's, then the Rambam buttresses this in Source 5, then we're dealing with crime, we have the obligation to protect people both physically and from financial harm. The Ravina Nissen does take a different approach, but we said, like, it could be supported from a different end. And then the Nemuke Yosef tells us that we have to use our seichel, we have to weigh the costs against the benefits when dealing with these types of situations. And Ravina Nissen says that the government specifically has the job to assess each situation in each society and figure out what is appropriate for any legal matter, not just for this, but he's talking about any type of law. Okay, any questions? Let's stop the recording first.